Donald in a kitchen talks about food. Donald in a kitchen talks recipes. Donald in a kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in a kitchen. We get together around this kitchen table and talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
This is KHOI Radio. We're a volunteer community organization, and lots of good people support us.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Yes. So how about all that water flowing through the area?
Oh, boy. Well, I was saying, nothing like a little flood to cause some excitement. It's thrilling, you know? And it wasn't bad enough, to, at least in Ames, to do any damage. I mean, I know I took the dogs to the old carpool and the bridge that goes over the river there. One end of it was submerged, and there was water in all the baseball fields. Of course, it's already gone. This was Sunday, but it was kind of fun, and there were several families there with young children kind of oohing and aahing, and the perfect flood. No problems, but, you know.
It's nice to remember the power that we live
absolutely
in the middle of.
Oh. And speaking of sort of a powerful visual, last night's, actually both the setting sun, because it was kind of cloudy, and the moon were just, the setting sun was orange and orange and orange and gorgeous. And then when the moon came up, it's just a little past full, so it's, but it's still quite large and round. It was also orange.
Orange, orange, orange. We're moving into
just
harvest,
gorgeous.
Harvest moon.
Absolutely.
Very good. Very good. Today, we're going to talk about tending livestock on a very small, delicate, and beautiful scale.
It's like an urban livestock farm, right?
Yeah, it is. We're going to talk about butterflies and some nice folks that raise them. And also, Donna will share some tips for making your own flavored sugars, salts, ice cubes, things like that too. But first, a clarification and an addition to a recipe that we presented last week. We talked about a recipe called, and this kind of relates to gardening, Aunt Tiny's Dirt Cake. And mainly, it's a lovely, just silly cake. And it was we discussed whether the Oreos should be crushed whole or take out these centers. And I got a response from my cousin. She has the original Aunt Tiny's Dirt Cake recipe. And so she also loves the show. So she says, three cheers to everybody in Iowa.
So what did she say about the lick out the cream frosting or not?
No, you crush the Oreos whole and layer them with the pudding.
Whoa.
But why not add some more
sugar? Very sweet,
of
right?
Of course. But you do save out, five or six just separate cookies to crunch and sprinkle on top of the cake to make it look like
with
this.
And those should be without the gooey
those
center.
Should, yeah. Okay. And, okay. That was the clarification, and the addition. And this is a suggested addition to the recipe, and highly recommended, but not necessary, but highly recommended. You can also add gummy worms.
I believe this recipe is posted on the website, Lana?
It will be. I didn't realize it would be such an outpouring of desire to find out about Aunt Tiny's Dirt Cake. If you want to find out the story of Aunt Tiny's Dirt Cake, go to khoifm.org, find the Donna Lana Kitchen web page, and go to last week's show, which I believe was entitled Too Many Tomatoes. And at the end of that show, we talk about the origins of Aunt Tiny's Dirt Cake. Yeah, do that. And you can find other shows there, too. There you go.
It's for children's parties, I believe.
Or people with a real
or
sweet
or silly
tooth.
Adults, yes.
Silly adults, yes. With us today are two women who love butterflies. And these are really nice folks who have interesting sorts of day jobs and interesting sorts of lives besides butterflies. Valerie Stahlbaumer is a acupuncturist working for the Story County Medical Center, and Karen Kraft is her office manager, also working for the Story County Medical Center. You can hear her fine voice if you call up and ask for an appointment with Valerie. And she also is a animal communicator, and we'll talk to her more about that later. So welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen,
you.
Both of you.
We're really
glad to be here. Good. So, Valerie, I often ask what's going on in your garden, and you were excited about butterflies. Why butterflies?
Well, I think people are aware that a lot of butterfly populations are diminishing, and you're probably not seeing them around as much as there used to be. They're very important pollinators, so they're really part of the representatives of all the insects that help produce our food. If food isn't pollinated, you don't get your green beans, you're not going to get your tomatoes, you don't get the food that you're counting on. Now, monarchs especially have been watched because they are the one spectacular butterfly that makes a really long migration all the way back to Mexico in the wintertime. Migrates there. I suppose there's a lot of people in Ames that would like to go there this winter, but the monarchs managed to do that. Well, the tragedy is, though, that only about 10% of them still exist compared to even this last,
right,
you know, 10 years ago or so.
The decline is really,
really,
really
significant,
radical.
Right.
Yeah. That's 10. Well, only one out of 10
exactly.
is still living.
Well, in terms of the numbers, right.
Breeding, mating, perpetuating.
Well, Karen had this great idea that maybe we should try to help. I think in the past few years, we just planted some milkweed because monarchs only live on milkweed. Their larvae, the young that are growing, the little caterpillars, they only eat milkweed plants, and the adults just lay an egg on the milkweed. That's it. So we decided to plant some milkweed plants, and we did that. But then Karen found out that really a lot of the young, even the eggs, get eaten by spiders and wasps and other things that, you know, they're trying to do their job. So Karen decided we should raise them. And how many houses have you bought, butterfly houses?
Including the one that you have.
Yes.
There are four of them.
Okay. So we
What is a butterfly house?
Yeah, tell
we
us
brought
about,
one.
Tell us about butterfly houses. And what you do. Karen.
Yes. There. If you go on the internet and look for butterfly cage, you'll see pictures. They are net enclosures that keep spiders and other icky little bugs out away from the eggs and the caterpillars, keeps the caterpillars inside and safe.
The house looks sort of like one of those collapsible net laundry bags.
Exactly. That's exactly what they look like, a little smaller, and the netting is finer.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
I also have one that's shaped like a terrarium, rectangular. Mm-hmm. And that's where I have all the adult caterpillars, the ones that are changing into chrysalises, and then all the chrysalises are hanging from that.
Dealing with growing intentionally, growing butterflies seems like a very delicate operation. Can you explain how you do
step
this?
Step by step, right.
Caterpillar wrangling.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the milkweed that we planted, we're lucky to have because it turns out these little larvae eat quite a bit of milkweed. So
first,
Karen,
you're harvesting your milkweed.
We have to pick some milkweed, and Karen found out that lives longer. The plants live longer when you put in some of that special preservative or what's it, conditioning for the water, like you would
with
the
flower.
Like with your flowers.
I really want to give a shout out to Flowerama because they've been selling me little 10-cent packets of cut flower food, and it keeps the milkweed perky.
Mm-hmm.
Because I tried to do this years ago, and the milkweed would just collapse.
Oh, that's right. If you're growing milkweed in a terrarium or
in
a cage.
Right,
yes,
cut the milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just pick one leaf at a time, mm-hmm. and I like to grow my caterpillars free range inside their terrarium.
Yes, and the terrarium is, it looks, there's a little, it looks like a little tree in there, but it's really the milkweed.
Sprigs of milkweed.
Several sprigs of milkweed.
Yes.
And different varieties?
We have a few different varieties, and it turns out sometimes they have favorite ones, but basically they're just really growing quickly and eating lots of milkweed.
Where do you find, how do you get started? Where do you find the little bitty, you must have awfully good eyes. How do you find caterpillars?
It's so interesting. You know, all these things we've learned since we've been doing this. The monarch only lays one egg on the bottom of a milkweed leaf.
One
That's it.
Egg
one
per
egg. moves butterfly. On to another plant.
Well, one at a time.
Ah, right.
Not sure. Some butterflies will lay clusters of eggs, but the monarchs are individual eggs, one or two per plant, so that there's enough food for the larva.
Oh.
Huh.
And then
In the breeding period, egg-laying period, sort of how many might they lay?
I guess
hundreds.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
But at different plants.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's five stages they have to go through before they get to the stage where they start forming into the butterfly.
How large is the egg? Can you see it with the naked eye?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Very little. It's white. And, oh, my gosh, how can we describe?
If you're pinheaded size or something?
If you're familiar with a really good, healthy aphid, they're about that size.
Oh. Yeah.
All right. How about the size of a quinoa seed?
Oh, all right.
Kind of like that, but slightly smaller.
So you don't need a magnifying glass.
No, but it helps.
They're very distinctive because they're oval and stand out from the leaf. And if you have a magnifying glass, you can see little ridges.
Yeah. Oh, yes. There's a picture here. We have pictures to hold up to the microphone here. And it looks like the egg, it looks oblong, and it's kind of standing on the narrow end. So it does sort of stick up. Look at that.
Looks to me like a teeny-weeny honeydew melon or something.
Yeah.
It's kind of waxy looking and sort of pale yellow or white.
And this is where you start gather these things.
Well, you pick the whole leaf. You don't try to take the egg off.
Oh, so you actually have to go out and find a few to put into your cage.
That's what we've been doing. Yeah, looking for the eggs. Sometimes you find the little caterpillars. And I can't pass up. If I see an egg, I have to pick it.
So do you think that growing the butterfly larva in your cages probably gives them a better shot at least making it to...
Exactly.
Okay, that's why you do it.
This is why I got started doing it this year. I used to do this as a kid. Enjoyed growing black swallowtail caterpillars on my mother's parsley patch.
Oh.
She wasn't very happy about that. But so I started reading that only 10% of the eggs actually hatch. Because there's so many predators.
And what's
beetles.
A predator for the egg?
Ladybugs.
Spiders.
Ladybugs.
Ladybugs for sure. The spiders, I know, go after the larvae once they're grown. I don't know if they go after the eggs. But
so this is like saving the monarch butterfly one pinhead-sized egg at a time.
Woo! Well, it's just like a small family. You're raising these little ones. They're all different sizes, and you got to make sure there's enough food there for them. And, you know, you cheer every time they get to the next stage. And then when they finally get to become – and this can take a couple of weeks, you know, before they get to a large enough size. And then it's just fascinating. They change totally, you know, into this sort of a long green – little elongated green sac, the chrysalis. That's what it's called. It's not a cocoon.
How big is a chrysalis?
I have a leftover part after the butterfly left.
A little less than an inch long.
Oh, they're also not very large.
No.
And once, now I'm looking at, it's what, not even an inch really.
Right, about 3/4 of an inch or so.
And I'm looking at the empty one, which is kind of a clear thing. Wow, it's very light.
Yeah.
The chrysalises are absolutely beautiful.
And what color are
they're jade
still...
green with metallic gold spots.
It is almost like a necklace of gold spots.
It is.
Yeah, and then there are little gold spots farther down. And the biologists have not been able to figure out what the gold spots do.
Really?
Jewelry!
I've seen those before. It's something about being... Way prettier than you think necessary.
These little
they look like little lanterns hanging there.
Truly.
Yeah. And turquoise, and a bright turquoise.
And when the butterflies are getting ready to emerge, the chrysalis gets very transparent. Mm-hmm. So they look dark because you see the insect inside.
Yeah. Well, so then you know it's going to just be a few days, maybe a day or two, and then finally the butterfly emerges. It takes a while because, you know, it takes some time to let the wings expand. They pump fluid from the abdomen in through veins in the wings.
So they're not eating their way out. They're
just growing. Yeah, it just splits. That thin little case that you're looking at, that splits, and out comes the butterfly.
Catching chickens, kind of thing?
Not quite.
they don't peck out of the shell.
They burst. Right,
they burst out.
Oh, they do?
Yes, they burst out, and the wings have to expand. You wait about a day, and then you see them start to exercise their wings and kind of flutter, and then we let them out. I was first taking the first ones out to Ada Hayden, really letting them have a nice, beautiful spot to get going. That was early August,
and right away, they didn't.
They just went right north, just like that. As soon as they went up, they circled around about 5 seconds and went straight north, because I guess that was still the time of year everybody's going north.
They're migrating. And what do they eat once they hatch out? Still milkweed?
There's some pollen of different flowers, but, yeah, they do
prefer.
Yeah, just different flower nectar. So,
they're looking around.
They love flowers.
Prairies, I suppose.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, native wildflowers are preferred. Mm. We talk about the different types of milkweed that grow in Iowa.
How many are there?
More than I was aware of. But the three major ones that grow here are the common milkweed. That's what you see growing in the ditches. There's also a swamp milkweed that has a narrower leaf, and that you'll find in more marshy areas, but you can cultivate it. We both have it in our gardens.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of swampy this year. You don't have to water anything.
And then there's something that they like to call butterfly weed that has the orange flowers that people often cultivate. I find the caterpillars are not quite as fond of the leaves on that, but they will.
That's a milkweed?
Mm-hmm. That's a milkweed.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. You can buy those plants here in the nurseries.
Yeah, I think I have some. I didn't realize that that was a milkweed family.
And just recently I found out from, I believe her name is Kara Jo Anderson, I mentioned this on Facebook, and she told me, well, that vine that grows all over your yard, blue vine, has sort of an ivy-shaped, elongated, heart-shaped leaf, dark green. It is either a form of milkweed or related to milkweed, and they will eat that.
Oh, really? I'm trying to think what it is. A vinca?
It's a weed. I've been pulling
like
it out for years.
No,
it kind of looks like an ivy. The leaves are heart-shaped, has little white flowers.
Maybe it's a wild morning glory, maybe?
It's similar. It looks similar to that.
Right.
And so I picked a bunch of that because I was running out of the standard milkweed. And so I ended up with vines throughout the butterfly enclosure.
So I shouldn't be ripping them out because I thought they were weeds too.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's so interesting is people have, you know, taken out most of the milkweed, the native milkweed, just because, again, they think of it as a weed. But it's a real important part of our whole ecosystem. You know, there's many insects that depend on that pollen, you know, that eat those leaves. And this is what we're saying about, you know, the monarchs, but there's many other, there's whole communities of insects. And I guess, you know, we don't appreciate all those connections that we have.
Truly.
You know, our health depends on the health of our environment. And what we're seeing is we're losing not just the pollinators that help with our food, but indicators that show our environment isn't as healthy as it needs to be. So that's what we're trying to help people, you know, learn about as well. I think there were a couple other names we were going to mention because they were helping us with our project. Nathan Brockman at the Botanical.
He's the curator at the butterfly wing at Ryman Gardens, and I emailed him with a few questions, so he's been helping us out.
Royce Bitzer is an Iowa State University researcher, and he studies a certain type of butterfly called the Red Admiral. But he's also studied a lot of different butterflies. He gave us the release cage. He let us borrow so that if we do want to take them to Ada Hayden instead of just letting them out our backyard is what we do sometimes now. We have a nice, safe way to transport them.
What is a release case?
Release cage. It's just another netted square, net-sided.
It's like a metal frame with netting around it.
Yeah.
So it can't collapse.
So then they have a safe place to fly in while we're transporting them in the car someplace.
Butterfly carrier.
There you go. Safe butterfly carrier.
So it's different from a butterfly house.
Yes.
Smaller? Is that
thing? Yeah. About a foot, mm-hmm. foot square and mm-hmm. nice loose netting.
This is a lot of farming equipment.
Yes, a lot of farming equipment, right.
I had no idea when I was raising them as kids. When I was a kid, they were just little you know, pickle jars with.
Exactly. Well, or you can, I know for my children and maybe my grandchild also, you can order the butterfly farm kit,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you get one of these butterfly cages. It's a little mm-hmm. smaller than the one mm-hmm. I have here. Mm-hmm. They're doing this a lot in schools, which appreciate.
It's a very exciting project for kids. We love doing it.
Yeah. Karen, tell them how many we think we've released so far.
I know I have released 30.
There's probably another 8 or 10 from me. So, yeah, we've got quite a few that we've let outdoors and,
well, and
move on to the
and
rest
the joy
of, lives.
Of being part of this whole thing. That sounds
it
wonderful.
It is. It is. It's really exciting.
Since butterflies are migratory and they have season and it gets cold here eventually.
Yes, actually, what only about the monarchs are migratory.
Okay. What about the timing?
That's a good question.
Are they going north? Are they going south? What are butterflies doing this time of year in Iowa?
Should be starting to go south now. Around the middle of September, you'll see the migration coming through. Don't see as many as we used to, but if you look up in trees, sometimes you'll see a whole cluster. You're talking about the orange sun. Well, you'll see clusters of orange up in the trees.
Oh, orange and black lines on them.
And what's the lifespan from the egg stage through till they're, what did they do, lay another egg and then they die? Or how does it?
There are, approximately 4 generations of monarchs each year, spring through fall.
From the time they leave Mexico.
Right. First 3 generations are just reproducing. And then the 4th generation is the one that migrates all the way to Mexico.
Okay.
They live, up in the United States and all east of the Rockies. This group that goes to Mexico lives all up in all of our part of the country.
Valerie's showing us a map, and Iowa is clearly
right in the middle here.
Travel zone.
Right. So as they move north during the spring, some of them are going to stay in the southern part of the United States where the weather's fine, and they can stay down there. But a lot of them are going to be moving north, and they are going to feed on all of our flowers and plants all throughout our country. There's a small group west of the Rockies that just settled in California for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a small group that stays on that side of the mountains and then goes to California for the winter.
That's the West Coast group.
Right, okay. The West Coast. That's right. But otherwise, the ones that are hatching now – so September, they're going to just kind of stay around their area, feeding for a while. And they kind of go through this reproductive dormancy, they call it, where they're not going to lay eggs anymore. They're not going to breed.
Oh, they're storing up energy.
Right. They're just going to go all the way south. And they stay in these old-growth trees in Mexico where they just hang there through the winter, not even eating. They stay dormant. So that's the other part of the problem, too, and they're trying to get that solved because there's been people cutting down those old-growth trees, and they need those kind of trees to live in during the winter.
So in the spring, do they lay again and hatch a new crop that would then fly north, or the same butterflies fly back north?
The same butterflies
really?
North.
Mm-hmm. So generation has to fly north and then fly south.
Well, fly south
and
north.
Then north.
Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, amazing.
I'm sure they know what they're doing.
Right. It is amazing that they know what they're doing.
The bottom line is the first 3 generations live weeks.
The music.
And the migratory ones live months.
Oh. And the migratory ones don't lay eggs.
You should be
they
very
do
impressed.
Once they come back.
Oh. I am impressed. These are super butterflies. I have to take this opportunity to remind you, this is the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI. We're back. That was fiddler Kevin Burke playing, guess what, a fiddle tune called The Butterfly. Yes, it was.
So that was a fiddle being a butterfly.
It was. And he did
very
a pretty
cool.
darn good job there. We're talking to Valerie Stahlbaumer and Karen Kraft about some visitors that come through Iowa every year, and they're doing their part to welcome them and send them on their way. We're talking about butterflies. We're talking about the migration and the fact that there's these amazing super butterflies that fly south from where we are and spend time in Mexico and then come back. Tell me about the problems that are happening in Mexico. They need a place to sleep in Mexico.
Yes, there are specific areas in Mexico that I believe they try to keep the location secret so that people can't go in and disturb them. Part of the population, the dip in the population was due to a bad freeze that they had in Mexico, very unusual, which killed thousands of butterflies.
Oh,
I think
goodness.
This was a few years ago. So between that and the loss of milkweed in their breeding areas here in the States, that has led to this precipitous decline. And I'm not going to say that I'm saving the monarchs, but I feel that it, you know, doing a little part to
make our contribution.
That's exactly right. That when I found out that only 10% of eggs survive to adulthood, and if you have them indoors in captivity, so to speak, it's more like 90%.
It's a good try. It's and like Valerie said, it has something to do with healing ourselves too. Anytime you grow a garden or raise chickens or raise anything, you realize that we're part of something a lot bigger than ourselves. I haven't seen a lot of monarchs this year. I have seen other caterpillars and other kind of butterflies. And do they all eat milkweed?
Only the monarchs, as far as I know.
Right.
And although that blue vine that I was mentioning, I believe other kinds of caterpillars also feed on that.
You mentioned swallowtails. I have seen swallowtails. And one can be sort of taken aback by the size of the caterpillars.
Right, the
larvae.
Even
there's pictures here. You, Valerie, you said the caterpillars grow amazingly fast.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. Just like from day to day you see them. Just that little bitty one after it's hatched from the egg, you can hardly see it. You know, I can't even describe it. Technically, it's 2 millimeters long. And then all of a sudden it's maybe, you know, half an inch, all of a sudden an inch, and then a couple inches. You know, just in days, every time they change to a new size, they're shedding that outer skin.
Oh, really?
So it's kind of like how snakes grow bigger. You know, they shed their skin. And so same with these larvae.
And what's the sort of maximum size that they get to be?
That's, I would say, a good 2.5 inches.
And like
is how
maybe
it appears
as thick as your like
little finger?
Finger.
Uh huh.
Ooh, they're so cute. I mean, they brought a. We've got a house of butterflies here.
That's right.
And I counted. I could find 7 of them. However, apparently there's 8 of them in there. But they're describe what they look like. They're just adorable. They're very colorful.
Well, that's right. They are striped. So everybody's probably seen these before. But they're like black and white and yellow stripes, and they have 2 sets of what look like little antenna. One of them is the front end, one of them is the back end, so it's sort of like a distraction to maybe a possible predator to figure out what's the front or the rear end.
I've thought,
when you watch them move, obviously you can see which is the right direction.
Well, that's right. They do have antenna, but it's sort of like a Dr. Doolittle push me, pull you sort
right.
of thing there. Yeah.
Yeah, they're a little longer in front, so you can tell which is the front end.
Okay.
Okay. And when they get...
And do they have eyes? Yes.
Someplace in there, sure.
Yeah. Yep. There's a picture with a little
It's amazing how fast they can move around, or sometimes they'll just stay in one place and just eat that leaf until it's down to just the little vein of the leaf is all that's left.
Yeah, and when they're what they call the fifth instar, which is the last time that they shed as a caterpillar before...
The fifth instar?
They call them instars. Each
like in stars, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. when they get to the size where they're an inch and a half long, if they're really stretched out, maybe about 2 inches, I love watching them. My husband's going to be really happy when they all fly because he doesn't see me anymore because I'm always sitting in there watching caterpillars. I swear they all decide that the same piece of milkweed is the best one.
Oh.
And last night I had 5 of them all trying to eat the same leaves. And it looks like a Punch and Judy show because they poke each other and back and forth.
Oh.
So
it's like a party. They're having a community feed.
Yep, that's what it looks like.
Oh, good.
And I try to keep the big ones separate from the little tiny ones because, unfortunately, the big ones are so voracious that they will eat right over the tiny ones if I don't keep them separate. So
is that why the mama butterfly lays only 1 egg per plant?
Correct.
Huh.
This is kind of interesting. It said in the back of this one picture, during the 9 to 16-day period from the beginning of the first to the end of the 5th instar stage, so from the time they're the first little caterpillar till they're the biggest they're going to get, they increase their body mass more than 2,000 times.
Whoa!
That's eating a lot of milkweed.
I'd have to eat ice cream to do that.
But isn't that interesting, Karen, how she's pointed out to me, and it's fun to watch them. You know they're getting ready to turn to the chrysalis stage when they're shaped like a J. They go find a spot they want to hang from, and they make this sort of like little silky connection. It's just a fine little threads, white little fiber that they attach themselves.
It sort of looks like a spider web, little pad of spider webbing that they spin from the mouth end. And then they do a U-turn and grab hold of it with their hindquarter pinchers. Not sure what those are technically called.
And
then they hang
J
upside
shape.
Down in a J shape.
Oh, lovely.
And then they spin their own?
No, they don't make a cocoon. They're already a chrysalis inside. They're already turning into this next stage.
So
the outside just comes off. They shed that striped outside, and all of a sudden there's this green little elongated shape, and then that shortens up. Karen's watched it, and she says they're really active. It's like all their muscles are moving.
It's
swinging
it's
around.
It's truly amazing. I've seen it a couple of times now this summer, and I can barely watch because it looks like it's so torturous.
Oh, it looks like birth.
Yes,
exactly. It is. Oh,
But it's the old caterpillar skin splits at the head that's hanging down. And
it's like this little striped sock.
Chrysalis starts to emerge. And the chrysalis has to writhe around in circles and back and forth to get all of that skin worked up to the top where it can fall off.
And how long does that process take?
That I've been observing takes about 5 minutes to work the skin all the way up.
Yeah.
And then the chrysalis is quite elongated from what it ends up being.
Oh, okay.
And
just starts contracting.
And so it's like spinning in circles and writhing, and the chrysalis starts to compress and become smaller.
It's amazing. And, they know exactly what to do.
Yeah.
They do. And how long does it stay in this beautiful little turquoise bejeweled?
Right.
Eight to 15 days.
8 to 15 days. Oh. Amazing.
You know, a lot of it depends on temperature, and there's a lot of little factors.
Okay.
You know, but, yeah, it's just amazing the steps they go through, and it's all automatic, you know. And then for this final change into the shape of the butterfly with the wings, that's just amazing.
Oh.
It's so fun, too, when you've actually raised them and you see them ready to fly and you're taking them gently out to be released, and they're all brand new. You know, how many times do you get to see a little butterfly?
How do you know exactly when to turn them loose?
I wait until I see them exercising and flapping their wings a little. Then you know they're ready to take off.
They're pretty fragile when they first come out of the chrysalis, because they have to get their wings. That fluid has to pump into the wings. Mm-hmm. And when they start opening and closing their wings.
Right.
It's like practicing their muscles, and then they start fluttering around a little bit, and then we know they're they're ready to take off. If we're going to have one of our deluges, I wait until the next day.
Right.
Good idea.
Let them out.
Oh, sure.
We waited when we had this rain before we released one.
We researched a little bit about this butterfly thing, and there really is a thing called butterfly farming. There are people that do this on a large scale. And I was thinking, well, that's good, but there's a market for butterflies. I had no idea.
Well, I'm sure Nathan would be familiar with these, the person at the butterfly garden here in Ames. At Ryman Gardens, because he would order some of those chrysalis cocoons from different sources to have in our butterfly gardens here, or the butterfly house at Ryman Gardens. And that's true, I'm sure.
It's become a popular practice to let them go at weddings and
let them go in schools,
For teaching purposes.
Okay.
So there that's true.
Are people, you could like, order a can of butterflies as opposed to rice at the wedding, the throw, I suppose?
I believe what they do is package them in those glassine envelopes, and they hand a butterfly in an envelope to each guest. And then at the end, when the butterflies are in that envelope, they're very calm, keeps them quiet. They open them up and let them fly as the bride and groom run out of the church.
Well,
talk
about being getting a blessing for your wedding. My goodness! So there are people that do this specifically for large events.
Yes.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And this is okay for the butterflies?
I'm not sure. I have an opinion on it.
Right.
But
the
man that I read about, and I'm sorry, I don't recall his name, one of the major butterfly farmers here in the States, is also very concerned with conservation. So even though he's doing this for a living, he's also trying to promote butterfly conservation.
Just that many more butterflies in the environment.
Plus, the South American places, the more exotic locations that are raising butterflies to sell to butterfly houses, butterfly wings, as we have here.
Right.
It's saving the local environment because it's a sustainable product.
Ah.
So,
well, good.
So, Valerie should appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, again, I think, this is making us more aware of the value of trying to establish more prairie land, more native prairie, having more habitat, right, keeping more of the milkweed, maybe needing to do this in our highway easements and, people doing this in their homes and property, having more milkweed and other native plants around. This is important not just, again, for the monarchs, but all the pollinating insects that we really depend on.
Well, then doing it in your yard is more significant than one would think. I read a statistic last week that lawn is the largest crop grown in this country. So some of that lawn could be given over to milkweed.
That's a good idea. And there's very attractive ones. We've got some really
pretty
ones.
Yeah, and if people don't want to grow milkweed, then growing native flowers, black-eyed Susans and echinacea and all those wonderful things, those provide the nectar for the adult monarchs, so you're helping that way too.
Well, and growing milkweed is, I remember as a child, releasing the milkweed pods and blowing them around. And it's
tradition.
Yes.
So let's take a thought for butterflies, and thank you for sharing what you know. It's wonderful that we can actually watch and be part of this wonderful process. Do you have anything else to add?
Well, we saw this little note in the newspaper that September 20th at the Blank Park Zoo, they're having a monarch festival.
Oh, good.
So it says, meet local butterfly and bee experts at the second annual Blank Park Zoo Monarch Festival, September 20th. And it says noon to 4. When you leave, take home a seed packet to start your own butterfly sanctuary.
Good.
And actually, they've even invited the kids to come. There's crafts, puppet shows, bug parade. Dress up as your favorite insect.
And we all must have a favorite insect. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad we get to be here.
Good. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You listen to KHOI 89.1 FM.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about butterflies and insects, and they have things to eat, and they enjoy sweet things, and so do we. We talk about things that taste good on this show. Donna's going to give us some information on sweetening up and savoring up your summer.
Yeah, some flavored sugars. I've been kind of playing around with it, and there are lots of things you can do, like sprinkle them on sugar cookies or on top of a cake or on top of muffins or rim a cocktail glass, and it's fun. It's a fun thing for children, too. Now, the simplest way to make flavored sugars is to get, dehydrated fruit. Either make your own or you can buy them, like strawberries come and what else have I seen? Oh, blueberries is a really common one you can find at the grocery store. And you got to grind them, but don't use a food processor. Use a coffee grinder or what I call my spice mill. I keep two coffee grinders, one for coffee and the other one for things like this, because it makes it into a really fine powder. And then since I usually use the dehydrated cane juice sugar, which is a little thicker, I also grind that in the spice mill with it.
Okay.
So it comes out more powdery.
Let's back up. It seems like grinding dehydrated fruit, there would still be a little bit of moisture in it. It seems like you'd add something to sugar that it would kind of clump up. No?
No.
Oh, all right.
Well, that really, the packaged dehydrated ones are very dry.
Okay. So we should get it packaged. I shouldn't take something that, like dehydrated apples or blueberries that I've done myself, because they end up a little
yours are chewy.
Rubbier. Yeah, yeah.
Well, maybe
dehydrate them some more.
Oh, I would say so. I mean, this one recipe talks about doing it in the microwave, which I don't have one, so I can't tell you how that is. But they've got things like basil lime sugar, which sounds wonderful. And they recommended putting it in the you put the basil leaves on paper towels and put another one on top, and then you put it in the microwave for about a minute, at high for 1 to 2 minutes, checking every 30 seconds because you don't want to burn it.
And then
they also dehydrated you peel the lime skin with a vegetable peeler, and you don't put any pith in it, so it's really thin. And so they dried it that way, but I think I would try it in the dehydrator.
Okay.
You're the dehydrating queen.
Oh, I'll try that. I never thought of making my own sugars. That sounds lovely. I'm one for putting, like, cinnamon sugar on my toast in the morning. I think I could experiment with some other
things on toast. Well, they have a recipe here for it. Let me read you some of the combinations. Apple cinnamon sugar.
Yeah, see.
There you go. You could do that yourself. So they suggest half a cup of freeze-dried apples or 1 ounce of apple chips. Now, I'm not sure I would use apple chips because they have some oils in them usually. A quarter cup of granulated sugar and a half a teaspoon of cinnamon. So mix those together in the spice mill. Then they have a strawberry sugar, which is just freeze-dried strawberries and sugar.
Would that be good? Yes.
On pancakes, I can imagine them.
Oh, yes, yes.
And it's a good preserving technique,
Right.
So, like in December, you're having your strawberry sugar on your pancakes.
Yes. Or on top of muffins. I like making muffins.
They recommend, put the muffins in the tin and then sprinkle it on the top before you bake them.
Okay.
Another recipe they have is blueberry sugar, which is just blueberries and sugar. Peach sugar, the same thing.
Think of peaches as heavy in water, but yes, you can get
dehydrate them.
Okay.
Basil lime, which we talked about. Another one is orange sugar, using just the orange peel and sugar. And this one sounds good to me. Lemon mint. Doesn't that sound good? So you could make those things now, and then in the winter, you have these bright little flavor things to add. Now, the other thing I was reading about is making your own flavored sugar cubes.
Huh.
So it's a little more complicated, but not terribly. The recipe here was to take raspberries and you blend them in the coffee mill too. Although I think I would use juice, press them and get the juice out? Because I think the seeds might be a little...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, why would you want raspberry seeds in them? But anyway, you mix the liquid, whatever you choose, into the sugar. And let's see what the proportions are. 1 cup of sugar and add 3 tablespoons of raspberries. No, 3 raspberries. Oh, my goodness. That hardly sounds enough. But the idea is that you want it to make it – they're calling it – I've read multiple recipes, and they keep referring to it as the texture of wet sand.
Hmm. Okay.
And then you have the options. Once you've mixed the flavors, you can pack it into either little tiny – like tiny – candy molds or cookie molds that are no bigger than 1.5 inches, like the silicone ones, mm-hmm. and let it dry. Now, I would say, given the humidity that we have, it would take a little while to dry it here. Or they also suggested packing it down in a cookie sheet that has a high side, and then you score it.
That makes sense.
And then, so you're cutting it into cubes, and then you let it dry a little bit more, and you keep kind of scoring it till you can separate them, and then you let them dry separately. But they're beautiful, beautiful colors.
Little teeny tiny sugar cubes.
Exactly. And some of the flavors that they were suggesting that we use were like rose water, lavender tinctures, like a lavender bitters. Also, obviously, a lemon would be nice. Something so you have just a little bit of moisture and some color.
Oh, that's lovely. And they do make little colored cubes.
Yeah, they show them pictured in like silver sugar bowls.
Oh,
you know.
Of course, the silver sugar bowl.
Yeah, or adding them to like. If you drop, say, a raspberry-flavored one and pour some sparkling wine over it, very nice. And just kind of using them for decorating cakes, too, especially if you've made them in molds and they have flavor shapes.
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, another taste. I just remembered. At Farmer's Market, there's a – one can find, because I have found, flavored salts and sugars and that sort of thing. There was a flavor that I came across called chipotle lime sugar.
Oh.
And was that...
chipotle lime sugar.
Yes,
not
sugar,
salt.
Not salt. And it's very good on popcorn. I'm sure you can do other things with it, too.
Oh, that sounds like a great idea.
But a little bit of hot in with the little bit of lime. That was very nice. And that I found that at the downtown farmer's
market. I think we could make your own, too, by just using the lime peelings and then taking the chipotle season, which is – chipotle's really a roasted ground pepper, hot pepper, mm-hmm. and mixing them together to suit yourself.
Very good. Very good. That's and you can do the same thing with salt?
Yeah. I would think you could make all kinds of savory combinations. As you said, there is a salt-flavored cellar at the farmer's market, mm-hmm. which I've enjoyed some of their products.
Yes. I never thought why do I need something else in my salt? But you get, especially on vegetables this time of year.
Well, and it's also, I have a lot of basil in the garden right now. Particularly Thai basil, I like to dry it.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah, because you can't buy it in the winter, and it really does add a lovely flavor. So we could dry it, but also then dried, you could grind it right into the salt, which is another big preserving way, and then just have it in a little jar and shake it on.
Right. And you only have to do little bits at a time. A little bit goes a long way, and experiment.
Thai basil, smoked salt popcorn in December? How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds pretty good.
Oh, yeah, we'll have to foodle around here.
Foodling is a very good
yes.
idea. Well, good. Well, I have some upcoming things to talk about here. Music Walk in downtown Ames is this Thursday, and next week is the Maximum Ames Music Festival. So keep your eyes and ears open for that sort of thing. Nothing like a bunch of music.
Oh, you know what else? Tonight at the library is the there's an ice cream social. Bring your children, and then after that, all the candidates for the school board are going to speak. So then you can decide. I believe there's 4 positions and 5 people running, so it kind of will help you decide who you want to vote for.
And the ice cream will certainly help clear your palate
and
your
mind. And there
will
be child care also during the discussions at the library in
very
the early
good.
Evening, I think 4 or 5 or something like that.
Very good.
So good. We have little sweets and savories to think about. We've talked about butterflies today. Thanks to our special guests earlier, Valerie Stahlbaumer and Karen Kraft, for sharing what they know about butterflies. Today we heard the music of Kevin Burke. And with a nod to all the rain we've been having here lately in central Iowa, we'll go out with some contradance music here by the band Tidal Wave. Contradance music from Quebec. This is a waltz. It's called the Waltz Bernadette. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Support this fine radio station. Go to khoifm.org, find out more about the radio station, and find our webpage there. Take time to watch a butterfly, eat good food, and enjoy life.
And foodle around a lot.
Yeah, foodle around.